This episode is sponsored in part by Airbnb. You know, Jen and I love trotting around the globe. You gotta trot, you can't gallop or anything. And Airbnbs have become our go-to for a cozy stay wherever we land. So when we finally decided to put down roots and build our own place, we thought, why not sprinkle a bit of that Airbnb magic into our home? We went all out, designed it with a spare bedroom that comes with its own exterior door. This way, our guests can come and go as they please, making check-ins and check-outs a breeze. We've been lucky enough to host folks come into town to visit family and friends. Inspired by our travels, we wanted to make their stay extra special. So we began adding little personal touches here and there, snacks, bottled water, a brochure with our local recommendations that we made, even some cool samples from our show sponsors. It's all about making our guests feel welcomed and cherished. And really, when you think about it, why let your home just sit there gathering dust when it could be your ticket to more incredible adventures? Turning it into an Airbnb not only brings in a little extra cash, but it's also a fantastic way to share a piece of your world with others. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Coming up next on the Jordan Harbinger Show.
But the mummies is literally, I would call them like servers of data that have saved all this information for thousands and thousands of years. And no one touched them because they saved them because they mattered. And today, we do have technology good enough to tell us so much about these mummies, so much about the past that we never knew before.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most fascinating people. We have in-depth conversations with scientists, entrepreneurs, spies and psychologists, even the occasional legendary Hollywood director, former cult member, drug trafficker, or tech mogul. And each episode turns our guests' wisdom into practical advice that you can use to build a deeper understanding of how the world works and become a better thinker. If you're new to the show or you're looking for a way to tell your friends about the show, and I always appreciate it when you do that, our starter packs are a great place to begin. These are collections of some of our favorite episodes organized by topic. They'll help new listeners get a taste of everything that we do here on the show. Topics like China, North Korea, negotiation, communication, persuasion, influence, crime, cults, and more. Just visit jordanharbinger.com/start or search for us in your Spotify app to get started. As I mentioned in some previous episodes, our AI chatbot is new and working really great. We're still working out some kinks. I'd love to hear from you if you find a kink. You can basically type in any question or query that you want. It'll comb all of our episodes. We're going to be indexing our articles and show notes soon as well, and it will find anything. If it's in Feedback Friday, if it's in an interview, you can type in how you might find out if something's a financial scam, how you draw a boundary with a parent, how to get an addict some help. What's a promo code for BetterHelp? All of that will work, and the bot will return a result for every question in a really neat and friendly interface. I love this. I think it's going to make the show so much more useful. I encourage you to try to break it or trick it. Go to the website, jordanharbinger.com, click AI at the top, and give it a go. Today, Emmy-winning Egyptologist and documentarian Rami Ramani. I love Egypt. It's a super fun place to check out and have a little adventure. I went there in my early 20s and just had a blast. It seemed a little bit sort of untethered. Egypt's having a rough time right now, and I wanted to highlight the country in a positive light instead of just focusing on recent political chaos. Today, we're talking about something that everyone can get psyched about, ancient Egypt. We'll talk pyramids, tombs, mummies, using technology like satellites to uncover amazing finds beneath the ground, and a whole lot more. This episode's going to get you curious like you were when you were a kid. That's what I love about it. And it's going to get you excited about what they're going to dig up next over there. I really enjoyed this conversation. Kind of a feel-good change of pace. Nobody got murdered or, you know, abducted. Well, there is a coup involved. Never mind. I take it back. Anyway, I know y'all have some fun with this one just like I did. Now, here we go with Rami Ramani. Thanks for coming in, man. I wanted to do a show about Egypt, and then I was like, oh, let's do something. Like, there's famine, there's military, there's civil unrest. And then I was like, you know, actually, maybe we do something positive about Egypt. Maybe we mix some of that other stuff in there. But I wanted to go back as far as I could to something that everybody knows and loves about Egypt, which is ancient Egypt. And that, you know, that's where you come in for the most part. It's kind of too low-hanging fruit to be like, tell me all of the things wrong with the country where you're from. And it's like, come on, man. They had an empire before people invented the fork.
That's very true. Well, that's also very hard to talk about. A lot of people do not realize that ancient Egypt as a civilization is far too long to try and explain or say something brief about. You know, from the first ancient Egyptian king recorded in history to the last ancient Egyptian king recorded in history is more time than from the last ancient Egyptian king to today. which means ancient Egypt was more ancient to itself at some point than it is to us today. That's how long that civilization was. And if you talk about any other place in the world just 100 years ago or 200 years ago, how different things were. Can you tell me about America 200 years ago? Everything was different.
I mean, nothing.
That's 200 years ago. We're talking about 6,000 years of history.
It's hard to wrap our mind around that as people that live 80 years or whatever and haven't quite gotten there yet and only live once. That means the ancient Egyptians had ancient Egyptians.
King Tut came in 1500s BC, around that time, which is about 3,500 years ago. Now, King Tut went and visited the pyramids, the Great Pyramids of Giza, which was about 3,000 years older than King Tut himself.
Oh my gosh.
King Tut is nearly as old as the pyramids were for King Tut. So for King Tut, he was going to visit his ancient Egyptian ancestors of the Great Pyramids of Giza for this ancient sign, just like us going to visit it today.
Wow.
That's how long this civilization was.
It's so hard to wrap your mind around. Think about that. He goes there and goes, man, I wonder if aliens built this. that's what we do when we go there, right?
I can bet you King Tut did not think aliens built his grand ancestors' pyramids.
During the time of King Tut then, this is probably a dumb question, but that's why I'm here. Were they still building pyramids, or were those like, man, we can't do those anymore. We just got to do tombs. Times two. We don't have the time, the resources.
It's very interesting because the Great Pyramid of Giza, for instance, mm-hmm. is one of the seven ancient wonders of the world.
Right.
The most ancient one of them all, and the only one surviving.
The other ones were with the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which...
Correct. Yeah. Everything disappeared. The Lighthouse of Alexandria. Everything is in ruins, disappeared. It couldn't stand time and nature and humans. Mm-hmm. But the Great Pyramid of Giza did. And the reason it was one of the seven ancient wonders of the world, or it is one of the seven ancient wonders of the world, is not because it's 1 million blocks, each of which is 3 to 5 tons each, stacked on top
of
each other.
It's a million blocks?
Absolutely, yeah. Stacked on top of each other in a perfect triangle. It's a perfect pyramid shape with no glue attaching them. And have lasted all these years. They use pressure to take the air out of between each stone so they can stick together for 6,000 years.
I figured they put limestone in there or something. No?
No, it was the air pressure. And it's a very simple method that has been redone today to check it out. But it's very simple. You make them wet. And as they get dry, the air gets sucked out and they attach together forever.
Crazy. Does Egypt get earthquakes?
Egypt has earthquakes. I've survived a couple. I've had lost friends too, but never affected the Great Pyramid of Giza.
That is so, because you would think, okay, well, an earthquake will take care of this because it's over 6,000 years old. That's a lot of earthquakes. And the thing just looks like, I mean, aside from the external cover of limestone or whatever it was that was supposed to make it white and shiny, they're in pretty good shape.
Absolutely. It is mind-boggling. I do understand why people would go there and say, it must be aliens. Humans mm-hmm. couldn't have done this. I do understand it. I do understand why. I'm flattered by it.
Yes.
Because it is unfathomable to your human brain to go in there and say, how could they have done this 6,000 years ago? It's somehow demeaning to think that us humans were capable of this 6,000 years ago, and we still haven't made it this far.
Mm-hmm.
If we were just as good as they were 6,000 years ago and kept getting better at what we did, we would have been so much further ahead.
You would think so. Yeah.
But we hurt ourselves along the way, often.
A lot of plagues, a lot of wars, genocidal stuff that gets rid of cultures and civilizations and knowledge and things like that. It's just really crazy. I mean, looking at how Egypt is now from a government perspective, kind of a mess, I think. Probably been that way for a while. But having a historical perspective that goes back thousands of years, it's almost like any chaos that Egypt is going through right now is just the blink of an eye in terms of Egyptian history. I mean, no, like this is a footnote in an Egypt civilization book that focuses on whatever came before and then whatever comes after.
Absolutely. And ancient Egypt went through multiple problems and multiple fallouts. After the Old Kingdom, ancient Egypt is separated into mainly Old Kingdom, Middle Kingdom, and New Kingdom. And the Old Kingdom is like the Great Pyramids of Giza and all that stuff. The Middle Kingdom is people that you haven't heard about too much. The New Kingdom is King Tut and Ramesses and Akhenaten and all these famous ones too. But between each kingdom, Egypt went through horrible time. It's been invaded by the Hyksos, people that came from the north that took over Egypt that were very rude. We found letters that said that king of the Hyksos who invaded Egypt was yelling at the other king of Egypt who was in the south, telling him, look, quiet your hippos, 1,000 kilometers away. That's 700 miles away. Quiet your hippos. I can't sleep at night. Stuff like that. on actual hieroglyphic inscriptions. And these times, if you look at them, when I study them, 6,000 years of history, I think of the Hyksos time as a moment. But you look at those times, and some of them are 200 years, 300 years. People have lived and died when Egypt was just a complete chaos in between being the strongest civilization ever.
And people lived probably to age 30 back then. So when you're talking 200 years, this is a lot of generations. And it's funny that they took the time to inscribe on some tomb wall or some pyramid wall in hieroglyphics, basically the equivalent of, I got beef with my downstairs neighbor. That asshole is super loud, and he's got a fat ass. And it's like, am I translating this correctly? This guy is just yelling about his neighbor's bullshit.
Absolutely. The things that make it, though, because it wasn't inscribed on a tomb or a wall. It was actually a letter that we found, a little pottery letter inscribed with it that we found. But it's funny because 6,000 years of history and everything you see about ancient Egypt today, everything that we've discovered, is calculated to be about just 12% of ancient Egypt. Everything you've seen in the museums, the Egyptian Museum is filled, 4 stories filled of ancient Egyptian stuff, pyramids, temples, all that is only about 12% of what ancient Egypt has. Still, 88% of ancient Egypt is still hiding under the sand.
Wow, that's exciting, actually. Multiple Emmy wins. You're the first Egyptian to win an Emmy, which is, congrats on that. 23 nominations, 9 Emmys. I mean, that sounds like a lot. But now, unfortunately, you're not the only Egyptian Emmy winner. In fact, you're not even the only Egyptian named Rami to win an Emmy.
That's very unfortunate, correct. Yeah. Yes.
100% of Egyptian Emmy winners are named
Rami. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, Rami.
Very correct.
It's a very unfortunate coincidence.
I used to love it, but now I can't even say I'm the only Egyptian named Rami to win an Emmy because of Rami Malek.
Yeah.
And another Rami.
That's pretty good.
Rami Youssef.
Oh, yeah.
He's also won an Emmy. Rami Youssef, the show on Hulu, Rami, great show. You should watch it.
So your dad used to produce, was it Discovery Channel documentaries about Egypt? So the family business then is what, documentaries and historical stuff?
I grew up in Egypt. And I remember I was always with my father and with my mother on set. And set is ancient Egyptian ruins, tombs never been discovered, with Discovery Channel, National Geographic, BBC documentaries. Making documentaries about ancient Egypt. And I remember starting to work with him at the age of 8 or 9. My father was the only person in town that was doing it right.
Really?
So yes, he was really good at it. It was called The Fixer, which to many Americans sounded like a drug deal. But
it does sound a little bit sketchy.
But it's not. It's just the local producer, a person that can do everything you need to make a documentary happen in the country. And I remember I was, 13 when he left me alone with the BBC production because he had another one that he had to do. My mother had another one they had to. And I was, 13, 12, going around, going to the Great Pyramids of Giza, seeing the general manager, the director of the Great Pyramids, saying, hi, my dad sent me. We're going to film here today.
He must have been like, are you kidding me?
No, he knew me all along. And that's what I had that no one else did as well is I was spoiled. I had all the contacts and the trust, which matters so much in Egypt, from all these people in the place. And I did documentaries growing up with my father all the way through.
Were you like a location scout? Is that kind of what's...
A fixer is a combination of a line producer, a production manager, a location scout, and whatever else a fixer does
whatever
that I can't talk
done.
About on air.
Yeah, yeah. Like smuggling equipment in through customs. There's probably some of that. maybe we'll get to that. You have your first credit at 11 years old in some BBC documentary. That must have been really awesome. Or were you so young you didn't even kind of understand what that meant at that time?
I was very proud of it, but I took it around at school. I showed it to everyone and no one cared.
No.
No one understood what that was or what it meant. And I thought, holy cow, I have credit. I didn't think I'm 11 and I have credit on a BBC documentary as the location manager. I just thought, I have credit on a BBC documentary.
Yeah, I'm in a movie. My name's in a movie.
And no one cared at school. All the other 11-year-old boys were interested in soccer, and I wasn't as good, so that didn't matter.
Yeah. I guess Egyptian child labor laws are a little flexible over there. If you're 11 and you're working on a movie, like, don't worry about school. Just go to the pyramids alone, well, with a crew from another country, and have them film it. And then you can make up the homework later, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's so funny, though, that your dad just left you with a client at that age.
I do remember a story when I was young as well with my father on location. They were doing, I think it was a National Geographic or BBC, a documentary about a shaft that goes underneath the Sphinx. And it was a newly discovered shaft, hasn't been opened in hundreds of years. We were all down on, like, filming the discovery of the shaft. No one knows what's down there yet. Dr. Zahi Hawass, who is one of the greatest Egyptologists ever to live and still alive, he is my godfather of Egyptology, as we say. But we were down there, and I was still a young boy, in the shaft. It's 2 football fields down behind the butt of the Sphinx.
It's 2 foot underground, 2 football fields.
Yeah.
Wait, so that's, they dug that deep underneath.
Yes.
Why did they do, is that because the sand is unstable, or is, what's the deal there?
Well, the reason they mostly dug that deep for tombs and places, and it always came later in time. Pyramids were at the beginning, they would make the tombs in pyramids. Mm-hmm. But then as time passed, they would make the tombs more hidden and dug inside. And the reason is the most obvious. Tomb raiding was not something of the modern times. Tomb raiding was something of the ancient times as well. That's when it started. And a great pyramid right in front of you is the sign that says, come here, there's treasure.
Right.
And since then, and tomb raiding was horrific, especially during the Hyksos time, when especially during all the invasions when Egypt fell apart and came back, every one of these places were completely emptied. You know, there was nothing found inside the Great Pyramid in modern times.
That's such a bummer.
Not a single piece of gold. Nothing was found inside. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of people saying, well, what was it really for? It was the Tomb of the Pyramid, but it was ransacked.
Right. For hundreds of years, over and over again, probably.
As a matter of fact, not a single tomb or temple that we've ever discovered in the modern times wasn't ransacked.
Really? So have we never found a tomb that is just, they didn't find it?
The closest ever was about 100 years ago, and it was King Tut's tomb.
That's what I thought. I thought that was the big deal about that.
And still, it was ransacked just a little bit during a specific time. They took the oils because they were most precious, but it was closed. But that's the only reason King Tut's tomb is famous. Because King Tut didn't live that long, doesn't have a great story, wasn't a great king. Was a child, only did it for 60 years. His tomb is the smallest tomb ever to be found in the ancient, in the Valley of the Kings. He had the least stuff ever. The only reason he's that famous is because King Tut's tomb was not touched.
So this is like aliens come by Earth in 1,000 years and they're studying automobiles and they dig up a Ford Fiesta. And they're just like, look at this. And everyone who knows cars is like, dude, this is, you don't understand. This is not the epitome of our technology.
Pretty much. Yeah. King Tut is the Ford Fiesta of ancient Egypt. Yes.
Sorry, Tut. You're still important. You're the only one that was intact.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you grew up around tombs, mummies. Did tombs full of bodies not rattle you a little bit at age 11?
It's funny because I only started getting scared of mummies later on.
Yeah.
Not when I was a kid hanging out with mummies all the way through.
Sure.
It's when I started watching American movies about mummies when I actually got scared of mummies. It was a beautiful movie, but then I went back to the tomb and I was like, holy cow, that thing might move and kill me.
Right, yeah, those little bugs are going to come up from the sand and eat you or whatever, those scared things.
Great movie, yes.
Did you ever think maybe they sent you in the tomb first to see if there was anything dangerous in there?
Now I think about it.
Actually, yeah. Now it's like,
The rest of that story when we were down in the 2 football fields down under the Sphinx's butt in that tunnel was that we went all the way down and Dr. Zahi is on camera finding everything. And then he finds a shaft, a little shaft at the corner of the bottom. The bottom ground was filled with water, underground water.
Oh, that makes sense.
And there was a tomb of a god in the middle of it, a sarcophagus, beautiful, beautiful stone sarcophagus. That's 2 football fields down. We can't barely breathe. We can, it feels like we can breathe, but we're starting to like not talk right because there's not enough oxygen down there. And then there's a little shaft up in the right corner. And they started trying to reach in there. They couldn't really reach in there. It's too small. And I know you know where this is going. Yeah. And it's that was the case. There was no robots back at the time yet to send them in. And Dr. Zahi just looked for a small child around.
Yeah.
And that was me. They sent me in. They carried me up to carry me. It was an up in the corner, right corner. They carried me up, put me inside that shaft. And I crawl in. And that was before I watched the movie The Mummy.
Sure.
So that was still, I was still fine going into little shafts under this thing.
Not claustrophobic or anything?
No, I was very excited. God. I was very excited. I crawled all the way in until they couldn't see me anymore. And I was yelling back about things that I'm seeing. Nothing exciting yet. And then I found at the end, there were like a limestone, what looks like a little gate, but it's not. It's a limestone false door. And it had a couple of hieroglyphic inscriptions on it. And I yelled them out to Dr. Zahi.
Because you could read it
I knew about the hieroglyphic inscriptions. I was still studying them, but Dr. Zahi was helping. I was yelling out the shapes and he was helping. And
sun, ankh,
a poop
bird.
Emoji. Yes.
Yeah, poop emoji, exactly.
And then I came back out and, you know, it wasn't significant discovery, but the feeling I had at that moment, that was the feeling. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Discovering something.
That no one living had ever seen that.
That's me.
Yeah.
And me, I've discovered it. And it's such an addiction that you can't stop doing it for the rest of time. There's a funny story about how archaeologists, it's a joke, how archaeologists walk around. And they always walk around looking down, just looking for things all the way through. If you look at any archaeologist walking in the middle of the desert of the pyramid, they're not looking up at the Great Pyramids of Giza. They're just looking under their feet as they walk because they could find anything at any time. And it's a feeling that they want so bad.
I see. I would not send my kid into a 200-yard deep underground shaft. But again, you know, he knew the feeling you were going to get, and maybe he wanted you to have that gift. How do you know it's safe to go in there and it's not going to collapse when you walk in there?
You do not.
Right, yeah. You couldn't.
You did not know, man.
Yeah.
But you at least get the confidence in the fact that this thing has been here for 6,000 years.
Yeah.
I have to be so unlucky that the moment I go in, it collapses after 6,000 years.
That's true. I suppose there's rules like, hey, if you see a big rock, don't push that big rock out of the way because it might be holding up the rest of the tunnel. There's probably some rules like that that you follow.
Absolutely.
It's just got to be such an incredible feeling. I understand now what you mean by that. Now, do you go to school for this at any point, or do you just learn on the job? Because you said you were studying hieroglyphics. You got flashcards or what?
I did go to school. It's funny. I loved what I was doing as a kid. Obviously, I was really lucky to be in that industry and discovering things, and my job is taking me to places that no one has discovered before. Every new discovery, I'm there first. So I was enjoying it so much that I did not want to go to college or university. I just wanted to keep doing it.
And you kind of already had the dream job, though. Like, people go to school for that, get a PhD, and then they start where you're doing what you're doing at age 11.
That's exactly how I felt.
Yeah.
And in Egypt, if you do not go to university, you're considered uneducated, nearly illiterate.
Sure.
It's a thing that you have to do. So I thought about it. I was like, what university can I go to that is easiest, that I don't have to worry about, that I might not even go physically be there, so I can keep doing what I'm doing? And I thought, wait, all the professors of archaeology, I get them in to interview them. They love me. Mm-hmm. They know me. If I go to archaeology school, I can bet I can pass because I have an in with all the professors. So I'm going to go to archaeology school.
Right.
And I did. It was a 5-year school. And you learn about hieroglyphs and ancient Egyptian history all the way through. We have modern history of Egypt, which is anything 2,000 years. And that's modern
that's history. That's so funny that modern history is just a mere, the last 2,000 years, everything else is old.
Everything else is old. And then, of course, a year into it, I learned so much more than I thought I knew. And then the passion starts kicking in because the stories are so fabulous.
Sure.
And the drama in the stories, too, is so fascinating. The father marrying his daughter and the son killing his father. It's like Game of Thrones.
It's like Game of Thrones and the Bible, except it's, you know, not fiction.
So it's so fascinating that I ended up being completely obsessed and I finished with straight A's, aside from the fact that I knew the professors.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Rami Ramani. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored in part by Airbnb. You know, Jen and I love trotting around the globe. You gotta trot, you can't gallop or anything. And Airbnbs have become our go-to for a cozy stay wherever we land. So when we finally decided to put down roots and build our own place, we thought, why not sprinkle a bit of that Airbnb magic into our home? We went all out, designed it with a spare bedroom that comes with its own exterior door. This way, our guests can come and go as they please, making check-ins and check-outs a breeze. We've been lucky enough to host folks come into town to visit family and friends. Inspired by our travels, we wanted to make their stay extra special. So we began adding little personal touches here and there, snacks, bottled water, a brochure with our local recommendations that we made, even some cool samples from our show sponsors. It's all about making our guests feel welcomed and cherished. And really, when you think about it, why let your home just sit there gathering dust when it could be your ticket to more incredible adventures? Turning it into an Airbnb not only brings in a little extra cash, but it's also a fantastic way to share a piece of your world with others. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Hey, if you're wondering how I manage to book all these authors, thinkers, creators every week, it's because of my network. I actually got this guest selection from one of you who heard of the show through another sort of node in my network as well. These are really high-value relationships. I recommend you build your own network, and I'm teaching you how to do that for free over at jordanharbinger.com/course. It's down to earth. It's non-cringy. It's not going to make you feel gross or like you need a shower. It's just going to make you a better connector, a better colleague, a better friend, and a better peer. 6 minutes a day, not even that. The course is free. jordanharbinger.com/course. All right, back to Rami Romani.
This is like the lazy route for you, right? It's like when you take French as your major, but then your parents are both from Paris. You're just like, I see what you're doing.
That's exactly what I did.
Like, oh, I probably don't even have to show up to class. This is going to be great.
Yes.
Yeah. I heard you're a beast at math, though, as well. Why not study that if that's so easy for you and interesting?
I love math.
Mm-hmm.
Math is my toy. I enjoy math so much.
I cannot relate.
I know. My wife says the same thing, but I enjoy it so much that it is my hobby.
Mm-hmm.
The fun time I have, I sit and do math puzzles. My kid is like, I have three kids, and my youngest is like me. You give him an iPad, and he opens the calculator app, and he stays on it for 30 minutes at a time.
Really?
But that's how I felt.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I loved the numbers. I loved combining numbers when I was a kid. I loved all that stuff that I remember at school. My parents would say, okay, you got to stop studying math, and you can only do it on your off time. And that was the thing. I only did math on my off time because I enjoyed it so much. Yet math professors hated me because I also enjoyed finding their mistakes the time. I was the kid that they kicked out of class all the time. But I love math. I love math games. I love poker.
Mm-hmm.
It's all math. And I'm sorry if you don't feel the same way.
No, it's. I would love to. I'm not judging it. It's just that, man, was I not good at it. And so when you're not good at something like that, it becomes something you develop almost a fear of at that point. And it's funny because I was in honors math, but I was the worst kid in honors. So I was like, I'm not good at this. And then I do math elsewhere and I'm like, oh, this is not hard. But then after that in college, I had roommates that were all studying accounting and stuff. So I'd always go, you guys handle the check and just tell me what I owe. I'm a product of that environment where
you were the worst of the best.
Yeah, which
is much better than most.
Right. But you don't feel that way.
Yeah.
It's kind of like if you were an Olympic athlete, but you always came in dead last, never medaled. You're just like, I suck at this.
But
it's like, well, you're still in the Olympics, most, buddy.
Yeah.
So archaeology is math. Do you apply the math to your work as an archaeologist?
One of my obsessions in archaeology is applying the math and the timeline of archaeology. It's funny because ancient Egypt is mentioned in so many different sources of history. One of the sources is obviously on ancient Egyptian walls.
Sure.
But one other very famous source that everyone has read is the Bible.
Yeah.
And if you consider the Bible just a historical book and nothing else. And of course, it's religious and emotional and stories. So the history is not made for history. The history is not completely right. But it mentions ancient Egypt and it mentions stories that took place in ancient Egypt. Yet, no one has been able to align both histories. The Bible does not align with ancient Egyptian history as we know it. We don't know when Exodus happened, if it happened, or when it would have taken place. One of my obsessions is to align those timelines to try and find the similar stories. Because here's what I personally believe. I personally believe that the Bible stories, whether completely true or not, they were always inspired from true stories, mm-hmm. at least. Everything in history is like that. Even ancient Egyptian history itself, the stories are not completely true. We've seen King Ramesses winning this battle and destroying the Hittites and the Phoenicians. And we go to the Phoenicians and the Hittites' temples, and they have destroyed the ancient Egyptian. History is written by the winners and by their writers. So the Bible is also an example of that, where the stories in there could be inspired from real stories if they're not completely true. Now, there are very similar stories in the Bible and in ancient Egypt history as we see it, which can be a theory that a lot of mainstream and strict archaeologists would shy away from. But I find it fascinating. There's a story about a king named Akhenaten. You would know him because he is King Tut's dad. Mm. But he was a rebel. He was a rebel that left ancient Egypt as we know it and decided that all the gods of ancient Egypt didn't matter. And there was only one god that matters. And it's the god with the power behind the sun disk.
This is Ra?
The god Eaton.
Eaton, okay.
Ra was the sun disk itself.
Oh, okay.
God Eaton was a newer god, and he was just the power behind the sun disk. He was closest, King Akhenaten, was closest to what people believe in today, the power behind the sun disk somewhere. And only one god, ancient Egyptians had many, many gods, but he said only one god. He decided to leave the capital of Egypt, Luxor, Thebes, where the Valley of the Kings is, and move somewhere else. And he took his followers with him, and he crossed the Nile to the other side where people are not supposed to be. Only the dead are on the other. The Nile splits ancient Egypt between the living on the east and the dead on the west. All the tombs are on the west because that's where the sun sets for the living but rises for the dead. And for their day, and the east is where the sun rises for the living, and that's where the temples that they pray in. But Akhenaten went and crossed the Nile to the other side, decided to put everything on the west for the living and the tombs on the east. So he just crossed wires. Everything was very different. And he was very hated back in the capital, Thebes, where all the priests of even all the strong religious leaders were completely against him, and they're very influential because he's basically deciding that they don't matter also.
He's going to eliminate your job. You're going to figure out a reason to get rid of him,
And they're very, very influential and very strong. Akhenaten goes to a place and says, I find this place. This is the promised land, as written in ancient Egyptian text. Mm-hmm. This is the promised land, and I will be here. And he decides that this is the new capital and builds the capital there. Akhenaten disappears at some point. He gets probably killed by the ancient Egyptian army that went back and took his son, King Tut, and brought King Tut back to Thebes. And King Tut then changed his name to King Tutankhamun, as we know him today. But his name was King Tutankhamun, which is the god that his father.
Oh, interesting.
So he changed his name and became a part of ancient Egypt. But if you look at the Bible as well, who else believed in one god, took his people and his followers, and crossed? In the Torah, it never says the Red Sea where Moses crossed. It actually says a sea of reed, a body of water with reed. That's the actual translation. The Red Sea is actually a mistake.
Like reeds is in the plant?
Yes, yes.
Oh,
the Red Sea was a mistake that we currently think about today, but it was never the Red Sea, even in the books.
This is like a Moses parable then.
There's a lot of parallels with Moses and Akhenaten. Very similar stories there. The army followed him and he crossed the Nile and he kind of defeated the first wave of the army. All these parallel stories are there. There's another story with Imhotep, the guy that invented the idea of a pyramid. He came, his name is Imhotep, which means I come in peace. Sounds alieny, but it's not.
Somebody told me to ask them, ask him about the I come in peace story. It's amazing. And I was like, it's going to turn into some alien shit.
But Imhotep was not an Egyptian, and he ended up becoming the secondhand man to the king, translating the king's stories of the days of famine ahead, which is very similar to the Bible story of Joseph of the Bible and his brothers. If you remember the story of Joseph in the Bible with his brothers, when Joseph was the youngest brother, that his dad loved him more than the rest of his brothers, and then his brothers took him aside and killed a sheep and went back with his clothes and said, Dad, we lost Joseph, he's dead, but they sent Joseph to Egypt, and then Joseph became the second-hand man to the king, translated stories to the king about famine, and became the strongest. That's a very similar story to Imhotep as well. So all these stories kind of align between the Bible and ancient Egypt. And I'm working on a project right now, very secretive on my side, but I'm trying to finish the alignment of religious history and ancient Egyptian history.
That's going to go over pretty well, I think, because a lot of people want to believe that stuff anyway. And that's always a good market to hit.
I agree, but I worry. Because also with religious history, it is religious. Yeah. And people don't want...
That's true. Some people are going to think, who is this guy to change or try to change people's beliefs?
They want to talk about the Bible as a holy book, not as a history book.
That's a good point. And you're a Christian as well. So before people get those angry letters, is it a Coptic Christian? What does that mean? I don't even know what that means. I know it's a type of Christianity, but I have no idea what.
Correct. I am a Coptic Christian, born Coptic Christian in Egypt. And Coptic Christianity is specifically Egyptian Orthodox Christianity. The word Coptic actually means Egyptian. It comes from the word Egypt, Gyptos in Greek, Gyptos Coptic. Coptic actually means Egyptian, but it became that sect of Christianity, which is very strict. And growing up, it was always called the original Christianity, is because when Jesus was in Egypt.
As one does.
But it's also very strict. We had a very, very strict Christianity. You have to fast most of the year. Most of the year was fasting. Oof. Yeah, every Wednesday, a lot of fasting took place. And my uncles are priests. My uncles are priests. So I grew up as an altar boy, too. So I'm very Christian before anyone starts.
Man, they put you to work, dude. Altar boy, mine shaft, or ancient, tomb shaft explorer, fixer. You had no free time. No wonder you weren't good at soccer.
that's the issue. Math was my free time.
Yeah, man, yeah. I'm getting a picture of your childhood here.
it was great. It was a great childhood.
No, it sounds awesome. It just sounds very unique.
Yeah, but I didn't go to parties. No. I want to go to parties now. Maybe that's what I should do now.
I don't think so. Okay. I'm 42. I don't know how old you are, but parties are overrated.
They're very hard.
Ancient Egypt over parties any day. So, okay, I realize how silly this question is, but in the movies, they often show someone getting a crazy illness after going into a tomb. I'm not asking if there's a mummy's curse or whatever, but it does seem plausible that you could get sick after going into what's essentially a grave full of water. Even if it's hundreds and hundreds of years old, it's got to be some crazy mold in there or whatever. I mean, it seems very possible, or some gross spiders. I don't know. Maybe they don't live that far down there.
I can't diss the curse of the mummies too much for multiple reasons. Reason number one is that there is actually truth to it chemically, scientifically. There is truth to it, the curse of the mummies. It's not an actual curse that comes out and attacks you.
Yeah, you're going to have to qualify that.
Of course. It's not an actual ghost of King Tut that comes out. But leaving a tomb closed for 1,000 years with live organic material inside and then opening it for the first time, going inside, is not healthy.
The air itself is just stale.
There's mold that has been building, and it's not healthy. Yeah. You're very likely, if you take that first breath in, and people didn't wear masks back at the time when they're finding these things, they're very excited. People having very hard time wearing masks today when they know there's a pandemic out.
You think anti-mask is strong now.
So a lot of that happened. People died after opening tombs for the first time. Chemically, it makes sense. Now, I also can't diss the curse of the mummies too much, because I think I've been cursed at some point in my life.
How's that?
I was on my show, Mummies Unwrapped.
I see what you did there.
On Discovery Channel. It's a great show. But I was on my show, Mummies Unwrapped, and I was in Egypt, and I was at a tomb in Amarna. Amarna is the place where Akhenaten had built the city, the new city he had built.
I see. Okay.
And it's in ruins today. And it looks like it's been in ruins for a long portion of time because it got destroyed by ancient Egyptians. But they're finding new tombs there every day. But most of the tombs they find, they close and they never open them again. Not much people go to Amarna. And if those tombs were in a city with no history, they would be the most visited tombs ever.
Yeah.
But next to the Great Pyramids of Giza and King Tut's tomb, no one goes there. I went there because I was trying to know more about Akhenaten. I went inside that tomb, and that tomb literally has not been opened for 600 years or so.
Oh, wow.
They know all the guards that have been there, never opened it. There was a story I was following, and I wanted to go inside. A guard comes in, wake him up from his bed, find his key. Key's lost somewhere. They have to break the lock to let me in. And the first thing he does after he breaking the lock, he actually goes, 1 second, I have to knock on the door. And I was like, dude, come on.
Pretty sure there's nobody in there.
I'm pretty sure nobody's in there. He's like, no, I'm not talking about people. And I'm like, he's going to go about the ghosts. He's like, I'm not talking about ghosts. Ghosts are elsewhere. He believed in ghosts, but not in there. He said they're snakes.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
I was making fun of you there for a second, but please knock on that door as much as you want. He does knock on the door and you hear the snakes rattling and coming out, and he knows what he's doing. So he knocks on the door a couple of times before opening it. So when he opens it, the snakes don't jump out. When he opens it, the snakes know. He then opens the door and we back up a second. Snakes come out of different types. They were like living next to each other. You know, snakes
Ancient Egypt had the asp. Right?
Yeah.
Is that a real snake?
In crossword, they call it the asp all the time. It's the Egyptian cobra, the version of the asp.
Oof.
And I don't like snakes.
No,
I'm not
nobody
sure about
does.
You.
Well, not nobody. Very few people do.
Yeah. They're sick people.
Especially in enclosed spaces. Yeah.
But we get them all out, and then we go inside and start filming, and I go under that tube, and I find things, and I'm breathing really heavy and everything, and there's bats inside, and the smell is so horrible. And I left that tomb. I did not feel well.
Is it just a moldy smell?
Bats. There's bats.
Bat guano smell?
So there's that ammonia smell, you know, that ammonia bat urine smell, along with there's been snakes in there, along with this just very strange smells all going in, and your body is telling you, stop breathing.
Get
this is not good. And the dust is collecting all that stuff coming up because we're walking in there for the first time. All this dust has settled. We're just walking, bringing it up. And I'm like, you know, I'm a host on Discovery Channel. I'm yelling at the camera and being very excited. And I'm breathing all this crap in.
Literally crap, probably.
Literally.
Yeah, snake and bat crap.
Yes, and maybe the curse of the mummies mixed in. And then we leave. And literally a day later, I was in a horrible shape in bed. I had fevers that went up to 107, which...
Whoa. Aren't you supposed to die before that point, actually? That's terrible.
Absolutely. We had doctors coming in. I thought I was coughing blood. I was hallucinating. And my kids and my wife traveled with me around the world.
Sure.
My wife was really, really scared for me. And I don't know how I survived it. That was late 2019, just 6 months maybe before COVID or something. You never know. Maybe I brought it out of the tomb. But the reason I'm telling you the story is because it is true. The scientific curse of the mummies is very true. I just opened a tomb that was closed for only 600 years, let alone for the 6,000 years one.
Sure.
And I was in a horrible shape the next day. So the curse of the mummies do exist scientifically.
Wow. It seems like that's really a bad fever. I mean, you must have just inhaled a lot of... Did they figure out that it was, you inhaled a bunch of essentially shit dust and it just coated your lungs and infected your lungs?
None of the doctors really knew what I had. They put me on a bunch of antibiotics, and I explained to them all where I was. And they said, well, bats, snakes, dust is not a very good combination for whatever it is. It could be anything. We have not seen this combination of symptoms, but hopefully these antibiotics work. And they worked.
Thank you.
I'm alive.
Lucky you.
I'm here today.
You came back with something else growing on you after one of your shoots, namely the woman who became your wife.
Well, that's the final reason I cannot diss the curse of the mummies.
That's right.
It was 2009. I was doing a show for Sci-Fi Channel called Destination Truth with Josh Gates. Josh Gates still does shows today on... Discovery Channel Expedition Unknown. He's a very funny man. He's a good friend of mine. But we were doing an episode about the curse of the mummies, King Tut's tomb specifically. And one of the crew members was a very nice, annoying woman that I had a fight with the day she landed in Egypt because she was fighting me over equipment and serial numbers. She remembers that story better than I do. But it took 3 days. And she was in love with me.
Other way around. Gotcha. I'm sure she remembers the story a little differently.
It took 3 days. We liked each other a lot. Yeah. And then she had to leave after Egypt, to Bhutan, which is a beautiful country, and then back to LA where I was already there waiting for her.
Mm-hmm.
We spent 4 months together and I asked her to marry me 4 months in. That's all it took. She came to Egypt looking for the curse of the mummies and guess what she found.
And she got it, So you guys decide to live together in Egypt, which I have to say is quite a move for her especially because I don't know a ton about Egypt, of course, but to be a white woman that moves from Los Angeles and is like, yeah, cool, let's live in Egypt. She's not moving to France. There's a big culture shock. There's a lot of different things that she has to get used to, I would imagine, in a place like that.
Absolutely. Egypt is not bad as you think. You watch a lot of news on here in the U.S., and it could sound like Egypt is this horrible place to be in. But the reality is, if you're having a happy life in Egypt, you're living like a king.
Sure.
And it was a part of the problem, and it is a part of the problem. I was happy in Egypt. I had a very happy life. I lived in a beautiful palace with people that helped in the house.
Sure.
It sounds horrible, but that was the life you get in a country where there's discrepancy between people.
Big wealth gap, yeah.
Massive wealth gap. That's what a lot of people here in the U.S. try to fight and make sure that never happens, because that destroys every part of society. Egypt has that. Egypt has a massive wealth gap. There's really rich people, and there are a lot of 90-some percent very poor.
Oh, wow. It's that bad. I didn't realize it was that big of a gap.
Yeah, and the rich are living on yachts and having very fancy cars, and they have very nice houses. But also, Egypt is a tourist destination, and everyone knows that Egypt's economy is based on tourism.
Sure.
So they have to appeal to tourists. So you could go to Egypt as a foreigner, as a tourist, and be very respected and very happily going around. You can do whatever you want. You go drink. If you get caught with drugs, that people are going to let you go. You're never going to be at fault.
Not going to try that one.
You're never going to be at fault as a foreigner in Egypt, because the relations matter so much. Mm-hmm. The way Egypt looks as a tourist destination has to stay that way. That's why any terrorist attack was always a massive problem economically for Egypt, because tourists do not come. And tourism is the second source of income for Egypt after the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal is the massive gate.
Sure.
Right? And both of them are based on stability of the country.
Right, that's a good point.
Any terrorist attack is a massive problem. That's why after the military took over the country in the most latest phase of ruling, of reign, which I can't even talk about too much for obvious reasons.
Because you have to go back to Egypt.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's different. You can't talk anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
I'd like to talk about the Arab Spring a little bit, if possible.
But historically, I can talk about the Arab Spring. Yes.
Yeah. Historically. We won't comment on current government, whatever. That's not a problem. I completely understand that. But overnight, the country just kind of falls apart, or the government in the country just kind of falls apart. This is 2011 for people who don't know. Because for those who don't remember / weren't watching the news back then, and who knows, maybe we're 10 years old if they're listening to this at the time. Arab Spring was a series of uprisings and revolutions in primarily Middle Eastern / Arab countries that ended up overthrowing the government of those countries. And Egypt was one of those places where this happened. And Hosni Mubarak was the leader for decades and decades, and then he just one day is kind of just gone. Growing up under a leader like Mubarak, right? I assume you think, well, this guy was president when I was born. He's probably going to be president in 100 years from now or after I'm gone, even though that's not really physically possible. Somebody like that, you just think this guy's never going anywhere.
He was God.
Right.
I lived all my life under one president. I've seen in the news in countries like America where they have different presidents every 4 to 8 years.
Yeah.
And it was the most fascinating. How is that even possible?
Right. How do they get anything done?
How does a president just let go? How does a president go and shake hands of the next president and say, hey,
it's your problem now. Yeah.
To me, that was just so out there.
Yeah.
I had one president all my life, and that president had elections, but no one would run against him. And he would win by 99.9% of the vote. And sometimes someone would be up against him that gets the 0.1% of the vote. Then that person goes to jail and gets killed. And that was normal. No one had problems with that. It was just life. It was so far that we could even change that no one had problems with it anymore. They just accepted it. And I lived my life that way. That when I married my wife in 2009 and she moved to Egypt and we had our daughter, Sophia, she was 6 months old then when the revolution started. My wife is white. My wife is half Jew. And my wife is very different looking than Egyptians.
Sure.
My daughter is as well. A protest starts boiling up on the streets on January 25th, 2011. And I think to my wife, this is beautiful. students are going out.
Yay, revolution.
It's so lovely to have protests and people speaking freely about what they want. And it started not against the president, because that's too far-fetched. It started because one kid was brutally, brutally treated by the police, tortured by the police for no reason as well, till he died. And he was a 16-year-old kid.
This is like what happened in Iran recently.
Exactly. Just one little thing can spark it. And when the people went out on the streets, my wife was watching, and my wife said, "Hey, I'm not too sure about this." And I said to my wife, "Hey, I'm the expert here. Nothing is going to happen. I've lived here all my life. All these kids will be gathered from the streets, and they'll be in jail, and nothing will ever exist." But social media existed. That was the difference. And that's what I didn't think about. The next day, on Twitter, it was craziness. Everything on Twitter, where everyone is, and everyone is going out on the street. And people can't get the news from TV anymore, because TV is the government at the time.
Yeah.
So everyone is getting their news on Twitter. So the next day, people went out on the street, and the police started stopping them. Police brutality started happening on the streets.
Yeah.
On Twitter, where people can see it now. Videos are being posted.
I saw a lot of this stuff. It was scary. You'd see a military vehicle just deliberately running young people over, and you're just like, you're angry. You're very angry watching this.
Correct. And there was a police vehicle. We're going to make a massive difference between the police and the military at that time, because they held very different jobs. The military decided to stay on the side, not help the government and not help the people yet, because they are a different branch of the government.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. I just looked like a military. Yeah. It could be militarized police, but like a SWAT van, basically.
But that's what was happening all around. And then the government made the dumbest mistake of their lives by, first of all, not doing anything about it, and instead cutting off the internet, cutting off Twitter. And that was the day we freaked out. Open our phones, open the internet to check what's happening, because we can't know what's happening. And Twitter is out. Internet is out.
Mm.
And guess what happens? How can people know what is happening? Is by going out on
going
the street.
Going out on the street, right. So oh, I didn't think about that.
Between
backfire.
an hour later after they dropped Twitter, an hour later, every human being was on the street. We're a country of 100 million people, a city of 20 million people, Cairo. Everyone was on the street. No police force with weapons. No, and Egyptians are not armed. Civilians are not armed. But no police force with as many weapons as you would want.
Mm-hmm.
That also consists of Egyptians.
Sure.
Will be able to stop everyone or have the heart
sure.
to start shooting their fellow Egyptians. So they had no choice but to do something very scary in that country. Take their police costume off and hide.
Go watch TV in their living room, yeah.
Which means an hour later, we had a country with no police on the streets.
That's kind of scary.
And that went nuts. It was lawless. The streets were crazy. And my wife is a U.S. citizen, so the embassy called all the U.S. citizens that knew that they lived in Egypt and told my wife, "Hey, it's time. It's about to get much worse. And now we have a plane going out to Cyprus. And from Cyprus, you can find your own way that leaves in 2 hours. You need to go now." She then asked them about our daughters, Sophia and me. She said, "My husband and my daughter are with me." And they said, "Do they have American citizenships or residence?" And I never applied. I never planned to go somewhere else. We were living in Egypt for the rest of my life. My daughter is an American citizen by birth, because she was born to an American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, "Yes, my daughter has it, but my husband only has a visa. I had a travel visa." And they said, "He cannot come on that plane."
Oh, jeez.
My wife, I remember that it was, she didn't think about it. She responded and said, "Don't count us in. We'll find our own way out instantly." She said, "I'm not leaving you."
You must have been like, "Get out of here. At least I can blend in."
Wanted nothing but for them to get out.
Hell yeah.
But she said that there's no way I'm leaving you behind. My wife is badass.
Yeah, dude. She's badass. But I know my wife, she would be like, "Peace. Good luck, man."
And
it's for the safety of our child. Bye.
I could see her still smiling, even though she can't hear you. Because
she can hear me. Yeah, okay. She can, yeah.
And then we started our own venture into leaving the country at the time. And the country was a complete mess at the time. There's another sect of the country called the Muslim Brotherhood.
I was going to ask about the Muslim Brotherhood because they kind of commandeered the revolution and it was like, hey, we're revolution. And then they were like, actually, let's make this some Islamic extreme kind of deal.
You put it exactly how it was. They did not start the revolution and they were always the little opposition that was kind of illegal, but kind of not.
Right.
And we don't have healthy opposition in Egypt, of course, because it's a dictatorship. So the only surviving opposition was an opposition that could use religion. But the Muslim Brotherhood are not like Muslims. All my friends were Muslim. I grew up with Muslim friends all the way through. 90% of the country are Muslim, so my best friends are Muslims. But the Muslim Brotherhood, they used religion to become the Muslim Brotherhood. So people with less education could believe that they are the way. The one thing worse than fascism is religious fascism.
Theocracy, yeah.
It is horrible. The Muslim Brotherhood took over the revolution really quickly because they were the only organized opposition. The army stepped in to protect the people and decided to side with the people at the time. The president of the country, Hosni Mubarak, 16 days in, decided to step down.
That must have been kind of jarring. Like, wait a minute, you're leaving?
It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. I had already left the country at the time. I was with my wife in Syracuse, New York, at my father-in-law's. We were thinking we're going to go back in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then he came out and he resigned. Hosni Mubarak resigned.
To go back to your original point, you're a Christian, you've got a white wife, and you're living in this upper class or upper middle class, whatever, neighborhood in Egypt. Not a great look when Islamic fundamentalists take over the country and the military or the police apparatus or whatever their goals were at the time, which was probably everything.
Between a day and night, all of a sudden, white people became spies, Christians became infidels, rich people became ex-regime. I was the three.
Yeah, you checked every box.
I checked every box, and it just wasn't safe for my daughter anymore. It wasn't. And Egypt is home.
Yeah.
Dude, Egypt was home. My wife left the greatest country in the world to come be with me in Egypt because that's where we're spending the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
And between a day and night, it just goes away.
It really sounds like what Iranians who left in 1979 say about their country. Like, wait a minute, we went from secular, and they had the problems because, right, they had the Shah and everything. Then suddenly you're faced with the prospect of becoming like Iran.
Yes.
No, thank you.
Yes. And that's a part of the reason why you can't judge what's happening in Egypt right now, because they have made a decision and the people have made that decision to not let the Muslim Brotherhood stay. And they were willing to go as far as let's let the military take over the country again and not have the Muslim Brotherhood. Because Egyptians are not like the rest of a lot more conservative parts of the Arab world. Egyptians do like fun. They like having fun. They like going out, smoking hookah pipes on the streets. The women are stronger. The women go out on the streets wearing skirts. They don't want that taken away from them. And that's why within a year of the Muslim Brotherhood rule, people went back out on the street.
Sure.
In numbers bigger than January 25th. And the army sided with the people again and then performed a coup. And you could have never called it a coup at the time because it was a big, 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 big no-no. Don't say that.
Sure.
It's the people's revolution. But it's technically a coup because of the people.
I mean, hey, y'all got a sneak preview of the Islamic Republic 2.0.
Correct.
And everybody went, nah, it's not really.
It was quick, too.
Yeah.
The things on TV, people coming out on TV saying how anything else other than Muslims are infidels.
Mm.
Women that have their hair showing on the street deserve to be burning in hell.
Oh God, that's
it was so quick from a country where like we're in bikinis on the Red Sea,
right,
drinking tequilas and having fun, to if your hair is showing, you're gonna burn in hell and you better cover every part of your body.
So you're stuck during this protest initially, right? So, and I know you spent the night in a food storage locker, which is kind of hard to imagine. What is that, like a big walk-in refrigerator kind of thing?
Well, we lived in a three-story home, beautiful, beautiful home, and it's Roman style. So the top story is like a pyramid shape, basically the top story.
You love your pyramids.
I love my pyramids. And when the revolution started, when the embassy called my wife on the phone, the embassy knew that something was going to happen that was worse than what we were watching. And that's when the police left and the country fell apart. And, you know, if Los Angeles has no police on the streets,
well,
a very safe, not safe, but a very civilized and first world city one day later, it's going to be a place that you want to hide with your gun somewhere.
Sure. I mean, you've seen the videos of the LA riots probably at some point.
Exactly.
It's going to look something like that.
So now, no police in Egypt, Cairo. There's a lot of bad people out there, and they target rich neighborhoods first. The neighborhood I lived in was the same neighborhood that the son of the president was in. Oof. It was a nice, fancy neighborhood, and we lived on 16 acres of mango trees, and it was just beautiful with our pool and our bubble. I lived in a bubble that I didn't see what was happening.
Nice gated
Gated community. It was lovely, lovely place, but it was a part of the problem. That later story.
Sure.
Anyway, of course, very quickly, people started jumping the gates and they were going to attack all these places.
My gosh.
And I have my wife and my daughter, and I don't know the art of fighting very well. I lived a very privileged—
Wouldn't matter if you did, man.
But yeah. I don't know what to do. My wife, on the other hand, she said, let's go inside the food storage locker. We went inside that room and we put the deep freezers in front of the door.
I see.
So no one can access that room. Even if they came in, they can take everything in the house, but they can't take my wife or my daughter or hurt us. And there was only one circular window at the top that's accessible. So my wife just goes into action so quickly. She had gathered sand from the land. And she put it in a pot with oil on it, and she started boiling oil and sand.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Rami Ramani. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored in part by Airbnb. You know, Jen and I love trotting around the globe. You gotta trot, you can't gallop or anything. And Airbnbs have become our go-to for a cozy stay wherever we land. So when we finally decided to put down roots and build our own place, we thought, why not sprinkle a bit of that Airbnb magic into our home? We went all out, designed it with a spare bedroom that comes with its own exterior door. This way, our guests can come and go as they please, making check-ins and check-outs a breeze. We've been lucky enough to host folks come into town to visit family and friends. Inspired by our travels, we wanted to make their stay extra special. So we began adding little personal touches here and there, snacks, bottled water, a brochure with our local recommendations that we made, even some cool samples from our show sponsors. It's all about making our guests feel welcomed and cherished. And really, when you think about it, why let your home just sit there gathering dust when it could be your ticket to more incredible adventures? Turning it into an Airbnb not only brings in a little extra cash, but it's also a fantastic way to share a piece of your world with others. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Hey, if you like this episode of the show, and I expect that you do, I invite you to do what other smart and considerate listeners do, which is take a moment and support our amazing sponsors. To learn more, all of the deals, discount codes, we put them all in one place. jordanharbinger.com/deals is where you can find it. You can search for any sponsor using the search box on the website, or better yet, use our AI chatbot right there at jordanharbinger.com. Thank you so much for supporting those who support this show. Now for the rest of my conversation with Rami Ramani.
Wait a minute. This is some medieval siege type shit.
My wife, you don't want to anger my wife, trust me.
Nah, she'll braveheart. You can go braveheart.
Scary place.
Yeah.
But she then boiled sand and oil and got it ready, because anyone that tries to climb that one access window, if she pours the sand and oil, the sand apparently will stick to you till you burn to death.
I would imagine. At the time you are boiling sand and oil for home defense, you're pretty freaking terrified.
It's my daughter. That's the reason, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Because at the end of the day, you know, at some point I felt I should go out on the street and be with the people.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have ever done that, whether I had the family or not. But none of that matters. All you're thinking about, really, you have kids.
I do.
You know how it works now. Mm-hmm. It's like all of a sudden, I'm a young, selfish person, and you're a young, selfish person, and then you have kids, and your selfishness becomes more about your family. You're still selfish.
Sure.
But you're selfish for more people.
It includes them.
Yes.
Yeah, it includes them.
And then your child, you go into that, I think it's biological. I mean, it's natural, the instinct of, you want to protect that child from anything. So that's all I can think about. How can we save her? And it was very scary.
So, okay, at that point, though, you didn't have to throw boiling hot oil and sand on anybody, hopefully.
We did not. She was very excited about it, but we did not.
Yeah, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But then you've got to get out of there still.
Yeah.
You're stuck in there. So how do you find your way out of this mess? I mean, people are hopping the gates. It's time to bug out.
The next morning, we decided to find our own way out, get in our car, and drive straight to the airport to get out. Now, I know everyone is going to the airport, everyone's trying to get out, but also I know the streets are the worst place to be on right now, even to get to the airport. is the scariest thing to do, because what happened at the time when police abandoned the country is that everyone started creating their own vigilante groups.
Sure, like neighborhood militia kind of things?
Yeah. So every neighborhood, 17-year-olds will go out on the street, create a checkpoint to make sure anyone that enters that neighborhood is trusted. But there's problems with that strategy, with that structure, is that first, every neighborhood has different ideology of sure. what is trusted or what is safe. Also, 14 to 17-year-olds are not the best judges of character.
No.
Including myself. I'm not judging them, but they're
slightly impulsive group of guys, generally.
Impulsive is the correct word. They act before they think, and we're hearing on the radio incidences of people stopping at the checkpoint and everyone getting killed in the car.
Oh, man.
Now, my wife, white, half Jew, my daughter in the backseat, 6-month-old, I put a veil on my wife's head, I remember.
That's a good idea, yeah.
I said, just so you can look less white, I guess.
Yeah.
It was a bit, we didn't have a veil.
It's an emergency situation. Yeah. No, we can't be PC about this.
Yeah. So, and it was, we didn't have a veil. We used a baby's blanket. It was a baby's blanket. It looked like a veil, but it used the baby blanket. She put the veil on top of her head. And we're driving through neighborhoods to get to the airport. I knew the neighborhoods well. I know that I could stop at that checkpoint and this neighborhood will look at us and they're like, respectable people, you can go. But there is that one neighborhood before we get to the airport that I know is very much Muslim Brotherhood leaning neighborhood. And to them, trusted and safe is not the same thing.
Right. It's definitely not a Christian dude with a white wife and in a car.
No, and it's not even a respectable, just like normal guy. It's more of really high energy kids that have been fed that Muslim Brotherhood is the way and that kill everyone else is the way.
Oh,
and they believe that they are doing this for the good of the world.
Right.
You know, and you're getting into that place.
They're righteous at that point.
Yes, they are the ones. No one else was going to kill these people other than us. We're going to save the world. So it gets into their head and they act. Before that neighborhood, we're in the car. My wife in the back seat, my daughter in the far right back seat, in the car seat. We're driving and I see the checkpoint the neighborhood has created. A bunch of 14, 16-year-old kids. And I see a kid with a sword walking towards...
A sword?
Well, they're using whatever they have.
Sure, I guess that makes sense.
And it was a sword. Everything on that day, looking at the streets, it looks like a scene out of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is just unbelievable. There's fire... And Egyptian streets on a normal day are crazy.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like normal rush hour traffic in Egypt.
This was really, it's just really crazy day. And a kid with a sword is approaching the car, you know, pointing up with a sword, using it as a pointing up and saying, hey, stop, we're checking the car. And I look back at my wife. I said to her, baby, we're not stopping. And she looks back at me. She's like, do you do what you think is right? And I remember made a decision. I'm not going to stop. I remember my thoughts that I know that the decision I just made, what it means and how my body's going to act. And I started training myself and all that with it. Like they are 100 meters away.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to run these guys over if they don't move, right?
Yeah. I remember my brain was training my body what to do. Because, you know, if you're driving a car and you hit something by mistake, before you think to stop, your body has stopped you on the brakes.
Sure.
Right? So I was trying to tell myself to not stop. I was trying to tell myself when keep hitting the gas.
Yeah.
I had to make that decision at the time. And I remember I started driving and I looked the kid straight in the eye, all his friends around, and I started increasing my speed. I looked him in the eye and I'm begging him without talking, begging him to jump away because I'm going to kill him. And I remember I drove straight and he raised his sword up and he started yelling, seeing me coming at him now, started yelling at his friends and he raised his sword up and I'm going and he scrapes the side of the car, falls on the sidewalk. His friends start gathering and I hit through their checkpoint and I go all the way through. You hear one of his friends had a pistol, fired a pistol up in the sky and the kid started running with the swords, but I'm gone. I'm out of there. I think I did not hurt him.
Sure.
I hurt him, but I don't think I killed him. He stood back up and he ran.
Wow.
And we were out. We left straight. We went to the airport and the airport was a complete mess.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Everyone is trying to get out of the airport. But a part of my job was airports. I got gear in and out of the country
legally
through airports. So I knew all the people in charge. There's a culture in Egypt. I can't say the word here because it's so horrible, but it's a culture of thank you with money.
Is it called bakshish?
Yes.
Yeah, I learned that word in Egypt, bakshish. Yes, it's like a tip. It's a little bit more of a spin on it.
These people are not taking this money and building palaces. They're literally going to buy dinner for their children because of it. They're underpaid. So it's a culture of thank you with money. I mean, a lot of people will be shocked by you going to a restaurant and paying a tip at the end of the day after paying the bill, right? But in America, that is the culture.
Yeah.
It's a very similar thing, but in Egypt, you do it with everyone. We go in and the airport is a mess. Lines till forever. We go into the Egypt Air office and they can't use their credit card machine because—
I was going to say, how do you buy a ticket?
The internet is off. Yeah. The government cut off internet, so their credit card machine is not working. They try to use the phone to give the credit card with a bank. And of course, all the banks are, the phones are busy. Like, that's the only thing working, a landline phone.
Right.
So that's not working. And my wife, again, just a week before anything had ever taken place, we had a couple of $1,000s in cash that I just brought in. Cash is normal in Egypt. It's not anything strange. Everything is paid in cash and the credit cards weren't really a thing. So you pay your invoices in cash and you have money with you and you put them in bank and then bring money out and pay with them.
Sure.
So I had $2,000 in cash with me and she said, hey, let's just keep those in cash here. You never know. But she said, let's just keep them on the side just in case. And I was like, baby, come on. The ideas you come up with. No. What are we going to do with those cash? We just leave them? They're going to rot. Rats are going to eat them. We're going to hide them under. She said, just let's leave them. I was like, fine. She has no clue in my head. And then I was the one that had no clue, obviously.
Yeah.
Because we had that money with us. When we go to the Egypt Air desk and they can't buy us a ticket with any credit card or phone call, we had that money. And they said, there's only two seats open on the hall flight that is supposedly going to New York on that day, and we're like, we'll take it. Our daughter, it was an infant, 6 months, she could ride on our lap.
Yeah.
We paid, or we had the cash. I was like, we have the cash. And they're like, you have the cash? And they're like, yeah, we have cash, yeah. So we paid for it right there and right then. We took the tickets. I had the baby and a baby Bjorn right on my chest.
Oh, I know, yeah. Got one of those, the chest carrier.
They're great.
Yeah.
Running around at the airport. And then once we had the tickets, we now are walking into security, but this line is not moving. We're going to miss the flight.
Yeah.
And all the flights are getting canceled and not. And a guy yells from the back, all the flights are canceled. No one needs to come. And I'm like, I can't stay in this line. I took my wife, went through the back door. The back door is where all the gear comes out. So I knew the guy. I went in. I was like hoping I know the guy's face. I found the guy. We had a conversation. And then he let us in.
Wow.
Let us in. We went all the way inside. We got straight on the plane. The plane was 1 hour away from taking off and we made it to the plane. We're very happy. This is the time. Safe. Calm down. The flight attendants said, we can't take off because the pilots can't make it to the plane.
Oh no.
So there's half flight attendants and the plane is empty. Like there's a 300 passenger plane, probably with 16 people on it.
Oh my God.
Well, no one can make it to the plane.
Because the security lines are too
long. It's just no one can make it to the plane. And then we stay on that plane for 2 hours, 3 hours. I can't even remember. And then people are trickling in. We're about 30 passengers on the plane. And then the pilot walks in, closes the door, doesn't announce that he's leaving, takes off, and we're up in the air. And a flight attendant comes in and says, water or champagne?
Oh my gosh, champagne for sure.
We went for the champagne and the horse meat, I think it was the meal.
Horse meat?
Yeah, it was champagne and horse meat.
That's an interesting choice of airline food, but I guess you take what you can.
Yeah.
That must have been the sheer sense of relief. The exhale when the plane is taking off must have felt pretty good.
Yeah.
Although you did leave your house. Where'd you put your car?
We left it. We just left it at the airport. Yeah. Well, you know, we had drivers and I hoped at some point in the future, if no one takes the car, if no one breaks into the car, one of our drivers is going to come pick it up. So I left it at the airport. And
there it is still to this day.
It was a couple months later. Someone went and picked it up and it was still there. I mean, it was broken into and stuff.
Sure.
But it was still there. And
wow.
Yeah, took it back. My parents were in a boat in the middle of the Nile. I tried to call them. My mom was so upset that I was leaving. But their boat started getting attacked by Nile pirates.
I've heard that there are pirates.
They were pirates on the Nile, which never existed ever. But, you know, it's just people trying to take over. It was a beautiful boat with a hot tub on it.
By the time you got a hot tub on a boat, it's a yacht. Yeah. I'm just saying.
And so they stayed on there for 6 months before they were able to land on safe ground.
This is crazy.
The country was a complete mess. We left. We went straight to Syracuse to my father-in-law who housed us. And I thought in my head, it's going to be 3 days, baby. We're going to go back. Everything's going to be fine.
Right.
And my wife goes, hey, at this point, you're completely out of touch. Yeah. You have no clue what's going on. I was like, but it's Egypt. I lived here all my life. I just can't imagine. I lived here all my life.
Sure.
I can't imagine it's gone. I cannot imagine.
I get it. That would happen to me here. I'd be like, it's not a revolution. This is America. What are you talking about? It's going to be fine. The police are going to retake control of the city. It's going to be fine.
That's a shocking realization there, though.
Yeah.
Would it happen to us here?
I mean, anything can happen.
No, but would it happen to us that we wouldn't see it still and we would not leave?
Oh, definitely. You might now have learned your lesson after that first time.
I'm going to tell my wife, hey, it's going to be fine. I've lived here for 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's completely fine. My wife was going to say, let's get out of here.
So were you able to get your money out of the bank in Egypt, or were you just like stuck in Syracuse like, hey, dad, can I borrow some money? And he's probably like, I told you not to move to Egypt with that guy.
But her dad was very supportive after our marriage, not before. Of course. I mean, think about it. This girl goes to Egypt and is going to, hey, dad, I found an Egyptian guy. I'm going to marry him 4 months in.
He's a filmmaker. You'll be thrilled.
Yeah. If this was my daughter, I would definitely be very upset. But her dad was very supportive, and we have a great relationship. No, our money was completely stuck in the country.
Sure, that's what I thought.
The banks are closed. No one can get money out of the banks. If you're in Egypt, there's a limit to an ATM machine. No one knows the value of the money anymore. That's the other problem. The country is completely, there's no government. So you don't actually know the value of the money. So if you want Egyptian money, how can you convert it to US dollars? We don't know the value of it. Everything is closed and nothing exists.
Oh, man.
Because it was valued at five something. Every five Egyptian pounds were $1 when I left.
Right. And now it's like, well, does Egypt still exist?
Yeah.
Is this money still valid? Yeah. Oh, man.
Somehow, though, not being able to access all our money, not being able to access anything, I had one credit card that somehow worked. I thought it was a mistake or a loop, a problem, but it's working. We would spend from it. And at the end of the month, they would take it from my bank account. And I don't know how that
worked. Incredible.
But it was that one credit card.
Really? Was it like a Visa or a MasterCard?
It was a MasterCard.
Because you got to hand it to them for keeping
it. It was a MasterCard. Yes. Thank you, MasterCard. At MasterCard.com.
Yeah. Sponsored by nobody. But you got to give them credit. There's a revolution, but we got you.
It worked. It worked all the way through. And that's how we lived for the next 3 months. We stayed in Syracuse for 2 weeks. And when I saw... It was the moment when I saw the president. That was the moment for me. When the president resigned, I thought, okay, we got to start over. That's when I applied to have a work permit and a green card in the U.S. Only when the president resigned.
Wow.
When he resigned, he's a god. Wait, God is gone. And then it struck me, we got to start over.
Yeah.
So I took my wife, my daughter, went straight to L.A., because that's what I know. I know how to make documentaries. And that's where my wife is from. She works in there. My wife landed, and the next day she was on a show, shooting a show. So she started working. A credit card is working. I kept trying to find a job, which was very hard in LA because...
But you have... How is that possible? You have so much experience. You know, like, hey, I worked on Discovery Channel since I was 11, BBC. Like, they should be like... stoked. Most production assistants are like, I smoke weed all day and I'm kind of interested in movies.
There is a saying in LA that I only knew later. If your experience is not in LA, it's no experience. By the time I was in LA, I was 25, 26, 27 years old. I have already had over 15 years of experience.
Yeah, you'd think that counts for something.
And none of it mattered in LA. It was just a new place. So I started over. I hate not working. I live my life working. I didn't go to school the way kids went to school. I enjoyed working. I think I do. I love it. My wife started working straight away and I was home. So I found a great source on the internet. It's called the Craigslist.
Craigslist. I've heard of it. Yes. Yeah. It's where you can find all kinds of people to clean your house naked or whatever.
Yes, yeah. But you can also find Egyptian camera people to come do your quinceañeras.
Your quinceañera? Yeah, I was going to say, like, were you doing filming bar mitzvahs or something like
that? I did, dude. Yeah. I did. I would apply for like 1,000 of these jobs because there's like endless list and 90% of them is fake.
A scam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I thank Craig for making his list. I would apply for like 1,000 of these jobs every week. I did count it once and it exceeded 2,000 across the time I was applying for those jobs. And I went like filmed. We had a camera with us. So that's what I used. I would go film like a birthday party and edit it and then take that money and pay it to the babysitter that babysitters in LA was probably a better industry I should have got in. They made so much more money than I did at the time. But then one of these jobs that I did was in a conference. I was filming at a conference. I met a guy. He's like, hey, what do you do? We talked. He was nice. Yeah. And he realized that I come from a deep background of documentaries in Egypt. He's like, I do documentaries all the time. And I'm doing one next week in the Dominican Republic. I have my team, my DP and my director already. But we'll chat. A week later, he called me. He's like, dude, save me. My DP and my director flaked on me because something horrible happened to them. Can you come to Dominican Republic in a week so we can do a documentary together? And that was like my first real job.
Wow.
And I was like, dude, I'll go anywhere. We went to the Dominican, did a great documentary called Esperanza, which is Spanish for hope. Mm-hmm. And it was about microfinancing and how these ladies broke the poverty of cycle, changed their life, changed their whole neighborhood because they got a microloan worth of $200, ended up building all these big businesses. And it's an awesome story. And these are really strong ladies. The women are allowed, the men are not, by the way. In the microfinancing world in Latin America, they don't give money to men.
Really?
Because of experience, every time they give money to the men spend it on drinking or whatever it is.
Wow.
They're not responsible. The only ones that are responsible enough are the women that have kids, because they will do it. And it's a fascinating story. And that was my first Emmy.
So you won an Emmy because you took a bunch of crappy odd jobs off Craigslist.
I mean, Craig, thank you, Greg, got me an Emmy.
Do you feel like being so different from Americans, especially, look, when you live in LA, and you know this, when you live in LA and you work in production, you're supposed to look like a person who lives behind a dumpster. I guess there's an unwritten rule. You know, do you think that worked for you somehow, that you didn't look like this?
Like a dumpster?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Like you have to look like a street person with a $1,200 iPhone.
It was a mistake that I did,
okay,
actually, when I first came in. I thought, I got to blend in. I was worried about how I'm different.
Mm-hmm.
And I did wear dumpster style clothing.
You did? Oh, so you tried to blend in that way?
Yes, of course. Yeah. I wore a t-shirt. It's very strange. I wear the same thing all my life. My blue shirt and my wife's jeans are much more comfortable. Women's jeans?
You're wearing women's jeans?
Oh my God, yeah. They have the stretch. They're very comfortable.
It's good for crawling around 2,000-year-old tombs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Trust me, dude. Go try your wife's jeans when you get back home.
My wife's 5 feet tall, I know, but you know, okay. I'll give it a shot.
Okay. But they're very comfortable. I wear the same shirt every day, same hat, and that's how I look and that's how I feel. It works for me. I don't have to think about it. I don't waste time thinking about it. I'm a director, and directors are very, you know how many directors it takes to change a light bulb?
No, I don't.
It's four.
Four?
No, wait, it's three. Wait, no, it's two. Wait, let's go back to four. They can never make their mind.
Okay.
Right? They always change their mind. So if I had to do that every day, I would just be out of time. So I wear the same thing every day. But when I first came here, I did think I should blend in. And I did not feel myself all the way through till I stopped. And one day I stopped. I said, I'm going to be myself. And I wore my stuff again. And I wore my hat again. And I went out on the street. And I felt like, do this. And I felt like everyone was looking at me. But then it took 5 minutes
for
me being worried about it. And then I felt like myself and I could do what I do. And 9 Emmys later, the blue shirt worked.
The blue shirt worked, man. I mean, you're working with, among other folks, Mark Burnett, who's responsible for Shark Tank. I think Survivor, was that one of
those
two? And this is like Hollywood royalty. You know, you're hobnobbing with the best of the best at this point.
Correct, yes.
And then I know you mentioned you're working on Mummies Unwrapped. And one thing that was interesting that you said was in another interview was mummies unlock other ancient myths and history, which I thought was kind of fascinating, right? So you discover one thing and somehow they're keys to other parts of history. Can you speak to that a little bit? I think that's really interesting.
Well, I think the key to our future is in our death.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
People do it today. You really go through autopsy and you really just make sure you know everything about how this person died. So you can know how what happened or what killed him. And the pandemics, you go through it today. You study the dead to make sure you're prepared for the future. Right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you look at someone's heart and you say, wow, he had a heart disease. Well, what did he eat?
Now with that technology that we have today, that we study our dead with, we take it back thousands of years. Mm-hmm. We have the dead thousands of years ago. We have mummies. They're just dead people. They're not toilet paper wrapped ghosts walking around. Mm. They're actually dead people with all their biological parts still in there.
I thought they put them in a jar.
What, you mean the intestines organs and stuff?
Yeah.
Yes, but their DNA material is still there. Their skin is still there. Their teeth is still there. Their hair is still. You look at those mummies, some of them look, they do
too
look
fresh.
Yeah, because their skin is still there. Wrinkles on their skin is still there. And all that is DNA evidence. And what archaeologists struggle with all the time is, if I start digging into this mummy today to unlock secrets of the past that would help us in our future, am I doing it too soon? Am I hurting this mummy? Am I getting rid of evidence that I could even know more later with more technology?
Right.
Like,
sure.
Think if they started digging into those mummies to find evidence 100 years ago. We would have not had it for the technology we have today.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Sure.
Now, what if we start doing that now? And 100 years from now, we can know so much more with just a little bit of that mummy. That's the archaeologist's dilemma all the time. You want to dig, you want to find more, you want to know more about the past. But if you dig now with the tools you have now, you might hurt some of the data that is stored into all these little pieces. Just a grain of sand can tell you more if you would waited 100 years. But if you extract the data from sand, then you solve the mysteries today. It's a massive dilemma that archaeologists have to deal with. But the mummies is literally, I would call them like servers of data that have saved all this information for thousands and thousands of years, and no one touched them because they saved them because they mattered. And today, we do have technology good enough to tell us so much about these mummies, so much about the past that we never knew before.
I heard now you use satellite images and things like that to find maybe not pyramids under the sand. Well, yeah, maybe pyramids under the sand, or at least tombs under the sand. How does that work?
It's very simple, like Google satellite images.
Yeah.
If you look at those images, you have to have the premium service, but that's it. But if you look at those images at different dates, dates where after a wetness, after rain, the sand itself, you look at it, and the thing with the sand, for instance, is that it looks different colors every time it's drier. So let's say a day after a rain, you take a picture, satellite image, of this part of the desert, and you look at it, and let's say there was rain. And let's say there's a pyramid under the sand. The top of that pyramid would be closest to the surface. And the sides of that pyramid are deepest from the surface. Which means, if you see a square of dark sand that gets lighter in color as it gets in, the sand in the middle is got driest fastest because it's least dense. And the sand on the outside is getting driest slower because it's more dense. Hence, you just found a pyramid under the ground.
Wow.
We used that technology with a fascinating archaeologist. Her name is Sarah Parkak. She's not one of the best. She is the best. They call her space archaeologist because she can find the pyramids under the sand. We used that technology. We wanted to prove it right. So we did take it to the Egyptian government and asked, hey, we believe there's a pyramid under this sand. They said, you're crazy, but with enough scientific studies, we were approved to start digging. And there was a pyramid under the sand.
It's crazy, those undiscovered, are humongous pyramids, and it's just buried under the sand.
And you can't even see them. The sand is all the same. Undiscovered pyramid under the sand. And it was laying right in front of us all this time. And the amazing part, the fascinating part, is that we didn't need to dig for hundreds of years around this area to find a pyramid under the sand. We just looked at Google Images on our phones.
Unfreaking believable. That's so crazy. So you, when you're on a dig like that, when you go and dig, I assume you need security and stuff like that to dig in the middle of the desert.
The thing, yes, you'll find this shocking, but what comes as a side effect of police brutality is complete safety. So when I lived in Egypt and we had very strong police, and brutal is a good word for it, police, it was very safe. I left my car open. There was no thieves. Huh. And no one dared to do anything.
Because they'd go to prison and, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, that is the side effect of police brutality.
Right.
Right, which is not a good thing, but
no,
you get that.
Right, the police state, yeah, the upside is security. The downside is lack of freedom.
Yes.
When I went to Egypt, this is more than 20 years ago now, we went all the way down as far south as you could legally go or safely go.
Yeah.
And then there was a military convoy that took us up in Jeeps. And I went on the last Jeep because, I don't know, I was dicking around.
Yeah.
And this is because this group, Abu Simbel or something, had killed a bunch of Greek tourists thinking they were Israelis. So they put me in the back of the truck with some soldiers and some other tourists, and they said, don't fall off. And he was definitely not joking because they were gunning it down the road. And we would bump up and we would fly up in the air. And I'm like, oh, no, I could really fall off. And they're not checking. Like, I'm going to just be in this road, this dirt road, and then what? I don't know. Just stuck there. That was really scary, because especially when you're at the end, you realize you're at the end of the security thing.
You're not exaggerating. That is a 100% true story. That's how they did it, to make sure you're safe, and they are safe.
They were flying, man. We were gunning it fast.
There was a time in Egypt where they couldn't control that area from terrorism. And there's a time in Egypt right after the Muslim Brotherhood got all, like, the government have declared the Muslim Brotherhood an illegal party, which means anyone that is a Muslim Brotherhood would go to jail.
Oh, yeah.
It's very silly. It's a very silly thing to do because you just call 20% of the people.
Yeah, criminals.
Criminals.
Who are, essentially so making them guilty.
You also make them criminals if they're not.
That makes sense and is kind of terrifying for what that sort of implies for the state. I know we're running out of time. There's a couple of things I want to make sure I ask. When I took a felucca up the Nile, which is like a small sailboat,
yes.
You'd have to stop and go to the bathroom. And there was one time where we saw a little structure on the side of the Nile. This is in the middle of absolutely nowhere. So we get out and I'm like, well, okay, we're done peeing. I want to look in this thing. All it was essentially a bush, a little structure, and a staircase that went straight down. And I think there was probably water in there because it was next to the Nile, but I don't know. There's hieroglyphics. They're still colored. Everything was absolutely incredible. And I thought, I can't believe we're seeing this. This is just like open. It's probably been that way for 1,000 years or more. And I'm looking and we realized that we probably should not just go down an ancient staircase into a tomb or whatever that was without any light. So we started to go back up and we realized the entire ceiling, which we thought was moldy, was just bats, furry little bats.
No.
Yeah. It was really interesting.
You are lucky, man, that you came out of that without the curse of the mummies.
Well, that and also just like, how dumb are you to go down a staircase in the middle of Egypt that's been there for 1,000 years?
But the ancient hieroglyphs, that's the addiction. You want to discover something. You want to see something that no one has seen.
It was pretty freaking cool. What is that though? Are there tombs just with stairs that go down? Why would there just be stairs that go down? I've always wondered what that was. The captain had no idea. He just goes, I don't know what that is.
The tombs with stairs going down, you're saying?
Yeah, it was just like a structure, like a nothing structure with a staircase that went just down as far as you could see.
The elevation from a pyramid to tombs buried on the ground happened because of tomb raiding. Mm-hmm. So once tomb raiding took place, people stopped making their tombs obvious. Mm-hmm. They had to dig down all the way and create a whole structure, like a whole burial chamber, multiple burial chambers under the ground to keep it safe from tomb raiding. Block the top. So even the priests that would take that body to bury it, they have specific amount of time before they get out, and a big block would come in and lock it, and no one will be able to access that tomb, whether they wanted to or not later on.
Really?
So it got harder and harder to get back into a tomb because of tomb raiding. So you went into a place where you were not supposed to go in.
Definitely.
And you are lucky that you have not been cursed.
Yeah, I suppose that's true, or at least bitten by a bat. Thank you very much, man, for your time. I know we got to wrap it up. I really appreciate the super interesting conversation. Super appreciate it, man.
Thank you so much. This was awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
As usual, I've got some thoughts on this episode, but before we get into that, I wanted to give you a preview of one of my favorite stories from an earlier episode of the show. My friend Steve Elkins found a lost city in the jungle that most people never even knew existed. I'm not even kidding. It sounds insane. This has to be one of the most incredible stories I've ever recorded on the show. I know you're going to love this one.
The legend of Ciudad Blanca, or White City in English, goes back probably 500 years to the best of my knowledge. People have believed that there is this civilization out there, and the local indigenous people have their own legends. It has about 5 different names, of which I can't pronounce, about this culture, this civilization that lived out in the jungle at one time. One of the other monikers for the city in current times is Lost City, the Monkey God. maybe there's some truth to this legend. I kind of felt there was something to it. The Mesquitia jungle, where it's located in the eastern third of Honduras, is one of the toughest jungles in the world, and by accidents of geography and history, it's remained pretty much unexplored until recently. I have a map made by the British in the 1850s, and on that map, it says Portal del Inferno over that part of the jungle, and it was called the Gates of Hell because the terrain was so tough. A lot of people have gone looking for it. Some went in, and some never came back. A director friend of mine introduced me to a guy named Captain Steve Morgan, and he was a lifelong adventurer, explorer, treasure hunter, raconteur. Nice guy, really pretty smart. And I said, let's go. And in 1994, we headed out to Honduras for an unknown adventure looking for the lost city.
For more with Steve Elkins, including the details on how they discovered the city and made one of the most important archaeological discoveries of the century, check out episode 299 of The Jordan Harbinger Show.